Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. We are now into the second year of the Trump administration, and the last year has been filled with ups and downs, important victories, successful holding campaigns, and painful defeats. We've learned a lot, but there's always more to learn and more to be done. In this now weekly series, we talk with organizers, agitators, and educators, not only about how to resist, but how to build a better world. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
Ashley Woodard Henderson, and I'm the co-executive director of the Highlander Research and Education Center in New Market, Tennessee.
Hi, my name is Jessica Bird, and I lead Three Point Strategies, and I am one of the lead organizers for the Electoral Justice Project.
I wanted to start off looking back at 2017, which was, you know, it was in the headlines the year of Trump, but it was also the year of some pretty impressive victories for some movement aligned candidates and for some movement strategies, particularly in the South. And so I wanted to start off by asking both of you to reflect on that a little bit. What were some of the lessons that were learned last year? What were some of the victories that were particularly exciting?
Good question. I mean, I think some of the reflections on last year is that, one, it takes a lot of intersectional, like, cross issue, cross frontline organizing inside and outside of election cycles to make sure that we are able to win some of the victories that we've been able to win in the South. You know, I think that it required lots of folks committed to political education through popular education. I think that what we saw is that it required a conversation about governance inside and outside of elections. I think we saw really, really amazing collaborative work between folks that were building movement around formerly and currently incarcerated people having a right to vote, like the work that Kenny Glasgow and the Ordinary People Society did, or folks, you know, really focusing on Black women voters and Black voters in general in places like Mobile, connecting issues of housing, you know, to why it's important to elect people that care about you, right? So I think that Alabama, I think in Georgia, I think in Tennessee and Kentucky, across the region, we've seen people through the Southern Movement Assembly having conversations about governance and how to build, you know, people's democracy. And I think that we're starting to see some of the fruits of that labor. I also think that what's real, and, you know, Sarah, we've talked about this before, is that, like, you know, there was not, I don't think many people in the region were surprised at the rise of Trump and white supremacy in its most overt forms, right? I think we even called it to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that these wins aren't like a response to Trump. I think these wins, I think in some ways they're related, but I think even more it's just the long haul work that Southerners have been doing to resist white supremacy and white nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that we're, you know, we're better than this. So it's really wonderful to see some of this work starting to come to fruition.
I also think in addition to all of the things that she mentioned, that creates a context and a soil that makes, you know, victories possible. And I also think on top of that is, like, primaries really matter. And where Black people, where low-income folks, where non-traditional leaders, where folks that are inspiring us right now, like trans folks and folks that, like, are running and able to win, is because we are truly engaging in the primary process at the local level. And we are engaging in a conversation around our values and around who we truly believe should be at the table and thinking about transformative public policy. And I think that's really important because oftentimes primaries make people really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But in particular, Democratic primaries are where candidates who have largely been left out of the system, like, have to engage in that battle in order to ever even access an elected political seat. And mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that 2017 really showed us that there can be a lot of excitement around new folks with better, like, more radical ideas can get elected and more radical identities.
Mm-hmm.
But that can't happen unless we get really comfortable with the way that, like, the battle feels, with the way that the election feels. And I think that we have to get really comfortable with that if we want to continue to see, you know, this type of radical change happen at the ballot box.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to... Both of y'all are in places and have struggled with these issues around, we've seen the real serious crackdown on voting rights in recent years around voter ID. It's not like gerrymandering is new, but it's gotten quite intense, and there's thankfully been some attention to it. And one thing that played an important role in a couple of elections this year was re-enfranchising formerly incarcerated people. So I'd love for you to talk, before we talk about specific elections or anything like that, talk about sort of the terrain on which we're even having elections and all of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Amber, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, you know, part of this part of elections that I think we talk about the least amount is the real structural barriers in accessing democracy. Like right now, our democracy is really an aspirational one versus one that, you know, we are actually finding the fruits of. And what happens as we attempt to continue to access it more and more, like, is that there are more barriers put in place for us to actually fully participate. And when I say us, I mean nearly everyone but white men who like own land and have a college degree, et cetera, et cetera. And so those laws largely were passed as folks were gaining access to democracy and access to voting and elected leadership and finding ways to make their voices heard in our electoral system. And so, you know, part of what the movement has to engage in as well is removing those barriers. And so places like, you know, Florida and Alabama and Georgia and parts of California, you know, have really taken on rights restoration and ensuring that incarcerated folks can vote as like just one basic step to several to achieve like the aspirational democracy that people so often talk about. And for the Electoral Justice Project, we intend to do much, much more. And engaging in places in the South where we're able to not only like work in partnership with folks who have been doing this for a really long time, but also to make that an intersectional issue. So, you know, what we know is that rights restoration is pretty bipartisan, and that there are folks across political parties, political ideologies who have been kept out of our system. And that's one way to organize and to talk about issues without getting, you know, really lost in some of the binaries that our DC electoral system would like us to get caught up in.
I think that what becomes ever more real in a Southern, you know, the Southern specific context, which is just what I know well, right? Is that,
yeah,
you know, even with the achievements of Black liberation movements before us, specifically around voting rights and civil rights, that we deserve more than what policy ever gave us, right? And so I think that the movement for Black Lives is really pushing, both in the Electoral Justice Project and through the Vision for Black Lives policy platform, calling for what we've always deserved and not just what we would concede to, right? And I think that looks like, you know, demanding even more protection for folks that, you know, are exercising their right to vote as one particular form of participation and building people's democracy, right? It's not the only tactic.
Right.
It's definitely one that we don't have the luxury to ignore, especially as working class Black people, especially in places that tend to be, you know, more disenfranchised, whether because you're a formerly or currently incarcerated person, right? We know, like, Alabama, again, is another case study for this. It's people who have never been convicted of a crime that are literally not being allowed to vote. And we saw folks fight and win protections for those folks. And over 10,000 formerly and currently incarcerated people were registered to vote in this last election. So I think, you know, we're seeing people actually step up and talk about what the self-determined governance looks like inside and outside of structures that exist. You know, I think Louisiana is another case study of folks that are like, why, if we're going to say that voting is a tactic that our folks should be participating in, then why aren't we making it accessible to people? Mm-hmm. Whether it's through same day registration, whether it's through, you know, making sure that we're doing intentional voter education work, and really being able to identify candidates regardless of their political affiliation that, you know, actually would want to serve our people, we should get to dictate that. So I think we're seeing more and more people experimenting in what self-determined governance looks like inside and outside of systems, including elections. And I think you know, folks like Alabama, folks like Louisiana, I think even Jackson, Mississippi, and our comrades there mm-hmm. are really giving us like play-by-plays of experiments that might be modeled in other places. And I feel really excited and inspired by that work.
Tell us about the launch of the Electoral Justice Project and the plans for it.
Yeah, it's really exciting. So the Electoral Justice Project, you know, I mean, I feel like a little bit of context and history about how I got to this place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Also says how important this is to me and for the folks who are working on it. So I'm in electoral politics for the last 15 years. And in 2014, as, you know, I participated really with my personal hat on in protests and uprising after the murder of Michael Brown in St. Louis, Missouri, you know, I really was asking myself about how electoral politics could be a meaningful tool for the movement. As I watched the movement grow, as I watched my friends become really visible leaders, as I put my life on the line and watched lots of others do the same thing. And starting Two Point Strategies was really an attempt to answer some of those questions. Like, could we create a bridge between electoral strategy and movement vision? Was it actually possible, or was our system just way too broken, mm-hmm. You know, way too exclusionary to do that? And over the course of these last 3 years, I started to realize that while our system absolutely is broken and that there are very real structural barriers in the path to participation, that there also was a lot of hope and a lot of self-determination in being able to participate on our own terms and in our own way. And along that journey, I was working on a mayoral campaign in St. Louis, Missouri for Tishara Jones. Mm-hmm. And I met Kayla Reed, who had been on the front lines of organizing in Ferguson, Missouri since August 9th, 2014. And she had really been able to translate a lot of that frontline energy into a very real, viable field program for Tishara, who folks in St. Louis really felt like was a movement candidate, was yeah. one of the first movement candidates really in the country to come out and say, I am running because of this uprising. I'm running to represent Black people and to really challenge the police. And so Kayla and I then began working together and building out the idea of this project. And we officially launched in October. And it intends to do three things. One is we want to build a political home for Black people across the country who feel like there isn't a place to actually dream and talk about transformative public policy. And so we intend to provide a movement help desk for anyone who wants to engage in electoral political work where they live across the country. And so right now we have a listserv of 15 Black political operatives who are just down to answer questions about how to write a voter engagement plan, you know, what's legally allowed to engage in elections, et cetera. And so we're really excited that gives us the opportunity to go really wide and to provide service to as many people as possible. And then this month, January 2018, we are officially launching the Electoral Justice League, which will be led by Rekia Lumumba and myself. And it is a intensive political institute for electoral organizers. There are going to be 20 people. The application is going to go live at the end of this month.
Yeah.
And what that's an attempt to do is to go really deep in 20 different places on 20 specific issues that movement organizations want to lead on. And then lastly, we just had, as a part of our launch, what we called Black November. And Black November was really an attempt to let people know, like, we're in the game for electoral justice. And yeah. so we essentially put out a call for any Black person across the country who wanted to hold a town hall on what it would mean to engage in elections in, like, a radical movement-aligned way. And we had town halls in November in every single region of this country. We actually had more in the South than anywhere else. We engaged thousands of people in a conversation about what they intended or what their visions were in terms of electoral politics where they lived. And so right now we're in the process of creating a really beautiful political map that includes all of the political opportunities that people are engaging in, the issues that people want to work in, and how they can get connected to each other so that we're not, so that we truly are a movement as we move towards November.
Talk a little bit about how this focus and these trainings and all of this will connect up to the work that's been done already around things like the Vision for Black Lives policy platform and the connections with movement organizing that's going on outside of the electoral arena.
I think that what we found in the Movement for Black Lives, right, is that when our ancestors and elders said by any means necessary, they meant by all the means. And if we're going to be pushing for progressive public policy, not even progressive, transformative public policy that, you know, will move us a little bit closer to freedom and liberation in our lifetimes, then we've also got to be able to have some sort of say over the folks that actually are the legislators, right, are the people that are controlling budgets, et cetera. So I think we totally see this in alignment with our multi-tactical, multi-ideological strategy.
Yeah.
I definitely think that, you know, some people are going to get down with policy, some people are going to get down with direct action, some people are going to get down with organizing, some people are going to get down with electoral strategy or multiple of those tactics. But, you know, we are not purists. We do think that it's going to require us to have some level of expertise in a multitude of sectors to be mm-hmm. able to build a kind of progressive movement that will get Black people free. And so I feel excited. I think the rest of the Movement for Black Lives feels really excited to have Bird and Kayla and Rukia and others on that table, really pulling together a cohesive strategy that centers love for Black people. And I think that's something that we haven't seen. I mean, I haven't seen really happen on a national level in my lifetime. And I think that to see people doing that with such intentionality about local people leading their work, about making sure that we're doing the sort of political education necessary to fill the gaps of where our knowledge is, I think it's really exciting. And to have seen, you know, hundreds of people get on calls, thousands of people register for calls, hundreds of people across the region and across the country really come together across different in their front lines, but all in unity about building a sort of political home where Black people feel loved. So it's really exciting to me. I think the work that the Electoral Justice Project is going to be able to accomplish is really life-saving for a lot of us. And I think it's really, really critical that these tables be in relationship with each other. We're excited about continuing to build the infrastructure for that to happen.
You know, we are in this time where the radical visions that we see, right? So like many of us believe in and are hoping for a world that we live without prisons, without cages, that we hope that we live in a world where everyone truly has access to housing and a place to sleep and enough food to eat, like really mm-hmm. basic things that feel really far away right now. And in order to achieve anything that looks like that, we need a movement in the millions, in the many, many millions.
Yeah.
And so part of what electoral organizing provides us the opportunity to do is talk to our people. And that is what we intend to do. We're not going to make any false promises.
Yeah.
And I promise, and I have promised everyone who we're working with, that I won't make any false promises about what electoral politics can provide in the short term. But what I do think that it can provide in the long term is the ability to have said that we truly talk to our folks, that we know what they want, that we know what their lives are like, that we are engaging with them by like calling them up on the phone and knocking on their door and going to like the bus stop where they get on the bus and going to the train station and like truly thinking about their every single day lives right now in the present. And my hope for electoral work and my hope for 2018 and then for 2020 is that we, one, can mitigate harm to our people and reduce the amount of harm that is being brought to them by this administration. I hope that we can provide them some hope by electing people who truly love them and are willing to say that out loud. And then also, I hope that what we do is begin to till the soil so that when we are truly ready for this like revolution that we, you know, are so fighting for, that we actually have the people that can do it. And I think that when you show up for people on a daily basis, that they'll be more ready to fight with you when you really need them. And so that's my commitment to this project. And I think that's this project's commitment to Black people.
What are some of the things you heard from folks in the town halls and are hearing from folks since you launched that they're interested in working on this year?
Oh, yeah. Oh, gosh, the town halls were so beautiful. So we're in a kind of a synthesis time now, and the folks who are working on this project, we're all meeting in 2 weeks to officially, you know, move into the next phase. So I can tell you even more about that as you prepare this piece. But some of the things that we've heard, one is, like, the way that we set up the town halls was that it would be a place of, like, deep dreaming and visioning. Like, Black people deserve so much righteous anger right now, and they deserve to be pissed off at this administration and at all of the shitty leadership across the country that says that it represents them and doesn't. Yeah. But what we wanted is to create really a space where people could come and say, this is what I want my community to look like. And so there were some places where they produced a brand new budget for their city that completely gets rid of police, where they were able to dream about a new park in their community or an after-school program or providing meals to every single, you know, elder in their community, like, 3 times a day. Like, there was really cool visioning that was happening as people were engaging in what their communities would look like if they were being led by someone who truly loved Black people. And then in other ways, like, people came up with tangible plans around what they wanted to work on in 2018. So we saw a lot of rights restoration, people who wanted to fight for ballot initiatives that ensured that incarcerated people could vote. There were also places where people wanted to, you know, unelect a horrible racist district attorney or prosecutor.
Right.
And so those all were things that were coming up, you know, across the country. And mostly, and I feel like I want to name too, is that we just got a lot of excitement around people being together. Sometimes what we miss in movement because we think so far ahead is that people just want a way to fight back. They want a way to feel like they're a part of something that feels like, you know, there isn't this huge DC power that be that has effects over their lives, and they don't actually get to do anything about it. And so we got tons of emails and notes and messages online of people that were just like, thank you for giving me a place to go to talk with somebody and to just say how angry I am and how hurt I am. And I want to fight back. And so that also feels really good too, for people to be building community in which they can truly, like, be resilient and resist what this current political time looks like and feels like.
This is going to be an election year, which is, like, always my least favorite thing, because it means that, like, the 24/7 news cycle is just stupid horse race stories about elections. But it is nevertheless a midterm election year, and we're going to be hearing a lot about elections. And so what and where are y'all looking this year for campaigns that are going to be exciting, things that might surprise people, and places where people are really pushing something transformative?
This is the number one question that I get.
I know, election years are the worst.
People are like, what's the map? And so I feel like I'm going to answer you in a couple of ways.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Ash should jump in as well. So one thing I feel like, because it's the number one question I get, is that I want to be really clear about, and, you know, I think that this trip to South Africa actually was really illuminating around this, is this is in no way, in any way, a project of the Democratic Party, like, at all. And so we do not exist in a red to blue, blue to red binary. Like, that's not what this project is. This project is not in service of a party. It's not in service of a particular organization. It's not like a special project for Black people that people get to just pour money into and then say that they did Black people stuff. That's not what this is. This is around truly building a ground up, localized, like, center of gravity on the things that Black people want to do where they live. And so that means a few things for us. One is that we have made a commitment to, you know, our movement, to ourselves, to Ash, to do, like, very real Southern work. And so our organizing program has committed that at least 10 of the organizers in that 20-person cohort are going to be placed in the South. And what that also means, too, is that these issues are going to be locally sourced by our or by our movement family and organizations who work there. So that's the process that we're going through right now, is to actually talk with all of our organizations and to say, like, what do y'all need capacity to do? If you could have an organizer work on something every single day for the next 10 months, like, what would you have them work on? And so we're building a map of both issue-based campaigns as well as candidate campaigns where legally allowed, because we do have a C4, but some of our organizations are not C4, and so we want to protect them. And then also, like, if we can just create a beautiful voter mobilization project that makes people feel excited and connected and also wins on a host of issues, then we also want to add capacity in those ways as well. And so we're going to truly attempt to be as many places as possible, and 20 places where we're going to go very, very deep.
Yes, yes, yes to that. I think, as per usual, energy is going to get sucked up, you know, around the elections. And I think that whereas sometimes social movements respond to that is to be really frustrated, I think our response to it is to be really smart, you know. And I think that for Southern organizers in particular, like, I don't know that we'll be super stocked about what happens over the next 2 to 4 years. I think that Southern organizing is going to continue to be the thing that saves this country, which is not a new practice, right? Like, the as goes the South goes the nation is not an opinion. It's a fact that we have concrete evidence for.
Especially now.
Blowing people's minds, doing that very everyday, grimy, in the streets, in the hoods, in the hollers work. And I feel incredibly blessed that the Movement for Black Lives is also a part of that Southern organizing tradition more and more. So, you know, on the C3 side, I think we're going to do our work. I think we're going to provide direct service to our people. I think we're going to come up with organizing campaigns and build alternatives while simultaneously exercising our power and flexing a little visionary muscle in the systems that already exist, while challenging them to do right by our people. I think we're going to continue to build the world that we want outside of these systems that have never been good for us, while also challenging power in the systems as they exist right now. And I think because of that, it's going to create entry points that all of our people can get down with and build the mass movement that our people have always deserved. And I feel incredibly lucky to get to be a part of it.
Excellent.
But yeah, I don't know that I feel like we're going to be, like, shocked by anything that happens. I think that what we're going to see is that, like, the Movement for Black Lives is going to keep doing good work that keeps saving Black people's lives. I think we're going to see a Southern Freedom Movement that keeps saving everybody because it's being led by Black folks like the Movement for Black Lives. And that's something to call home about and be really excited about, I think.
Anything else that y'all think people should know about this project or where the movement is right now?
Well, you know, one thing that we keep saying is that the day after Election Day, that we are going to wake up to this beautiful headline that says the Movement for Black Lives sparks the largest Black political renaissance in the last 50 years. And part of the reason that is so motivating is that we truly believe that we have everything that we need to be building an independent Black political core that really motivates, inspires people. But also, when they look around their day-to-day lives, they're like, this is actually changing my life. This is actually making my life better. And that's really the point of this project. And so, do I think that in 2018 that we're going to win everything everywhere? Maybe not. But what I do think is that for one of the most clear times in history, we actually have the ability to talk specifically about what Black people need, what Black people deserve, and the way that Black people should be led. And this project intends to do that every single day of this election cycle. And I think we're going to do it in a way that makes even you, Sarah, feel not tired of hearing about it. Because it's so good.
Excellent.
And so delicious and so inspiring and so centered on the real stories of what's happening in the community that it's going to make wins later on possible that we might not have even been able to dream up. So
I feel like I'm a recovering ultra leftist in conversations like this. I think like I think that what's real is that I think our people's frustration with all the systems that exist that have harmed us in the past or not served us, and how that segregates lumped into all things electoral, I think will feel different because this is different, right? If this is not about some single party that's, you know, only talking to us around an election cycle, and is really just telling us what we should be concerned about and not listening to what we're saying we're concerned about. But this has really been an exercise from top to bottom and really listening to what the most marginalized of our communities really feel, right? Like listening to Black working class people talk to each other about what they want and then synthesizing that and helping to support the building of the capacity to be able to get what they want, regardless of the tactic. And I think that is going to mean that this particular round of work that includes elections but is also very much bigger than that, I think it's going to give people something to feel excited about versus something that we're only doing because it's a crisis and we need to strap up and save each other. I think that's something really, really powerful. I think that's literally the important everyday kind of life-saving work that base building does. And I think that as much as this is an electoral project, absolutely, and big up to the comrades who are experts in that field, what's exciting to me is that this is also about people building their own power and make decisions about stuff that happens to them every day. And that to me is a radical, revolutionary act. I think that's the kind of movement that we're trying to build, and I think that we would be remiss not to have folks like the EJP squad, helping to support our people that are telling us that this is a tactic that they have to exercise if they're going to be able to survive the next 4 years. You know what I mean? So I think to me, the reason that I don't feel exhausted by conversations about elections is because we're literally seeing that when we meet our people where they're at, give them the resources to build the capacity to get to where they want to go, that we can win. And our people, I think, are thirsty for models of how to win right now.
All right. And how can people get involved in the project and keep up with the both of you?
So they can text EJP to 91990, and then they'll be added to our email list and text list, and they will get all the updates about this project. And then they can also visit ejp.infobl.org and check out our website, what our vision is for 2018, as well as sign up to be a part of this project.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.